25thFrameMedia.com, a listener-supported network celebrating film and culture worldwide.
Hello. Welcome back to Film Baby Film, a podcast for people who love movies or films if you're being pretentious. My name is John Lobager, and I am your host. Today, we are joined by one of my favorite movie podcasters and just one of my favorite people, Marcus Pinn. You might know him from his writings on Pinland Empire. You might know him from Zebras in America, his podcast with Scott. You definitely should know him from Twitter, Side by Side King. Just a great eye for film history and the visual connections between movies over time. It's really cool. So I have been a fan of Marcus's for a while, so it's great to finally have him on and talk to him. We're going to be discussing the Jake Gyllenhaal, Dan Gilroy doubleheader, Nightcrawler, and then Velvet Buzzsaw. So a couple of quite interesting movies, and the conversation was great. I got a couple of other very exciting things coming out pretty soon. I'm thinking next Monday it will be a holiday, so perhaps next Tuesday, but early next week I'm going to release the conversation I had with Martin Kessler from FlixWise and FlixWise Canada, and we'll be discussing Alexis Guermand's Kristalioff My Car. So this is our second Alexis Guermand episode, and that's really exciting. Also, have another episode. I'm going to tease this a little bit. I got a couple of people who haven't been on the podcast before. We're going to be discussing one of Ingmar Bergman's most famous and challenging films. So that's going to be awesome. One of my favorite conversations I've ever had. So, yeah, a lot of great stuff. But I think without further ado, let's get to the conversation with Marcus Pinn. Jake Gyllenhaal, Dan Gilroy, Film Baby Film. My Skype is lighting up. People are asking me to join like a Godzilla call because they don't know that I'm talking to you. So everybody's fired up about the Spine 1000. Yeah, I saw your collection at the house and it was like you could tell that you bought a lot of Criterions a long time ago.
Dude, I've got like out of print ones. Like I have Dead Ringers, Silence of the Lambs, RoboCop. Like I got those like the old, like, you know, the ones that came out in like 2002 or 2001, 2003, like all that stuff.
Yeah,
like Down by Law, Slacker, like all the older ones. This sounds crazy, I don't even own a Blu-ray. Well, actually that's not true. I do now at the housewarming that you were at. A friend of ours got us a Blu-ray player, but since I've never even had I had one Blu-ray. It was Tree of Life, and that's only because I bought the DVD, and it came with like the regular DVD, the Blu-ray, and like a digital copy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, to some extent, with living in New York City, it's like you can just go to the movie theater whenever you want, and then on top of it, with Criterion Channel or whatever, you know, you don't really need to. They keep on trying to call me.
Oh,
you don't even really need to like have, you don't need to buy a ton of Blu-rays and you still get to see everything.
Yeah. I mean, I have a nice, digital collection, the movies on Amazon Amazon Prime have been great, you know, recently. You could just rent just about anything on YouTube. Again, showing my age, I go back to when, you know, for a long time, you know, there was like a Criterion Channel on Hulu.
I remember that.
Yeah, and all of that stuff. So, yeah, it got to a point where I was like, I don't really need to, like, buy much. I mean, at this point, I would love to have digitized everything, but there's only, like, a small handful of, like, actual physical movies that I have that I'd want to keep. Like, I have, speaking of Criterion, I have that the original Eraserhead DVD that you had to like get from David Lynch's like website. It comes in this big like 10 by 10 inch box that like you open. It's like cool when you open it up. It's like this whole fold out thing. I have a copy of U.S. Go Home, which I don't think anyone has a copy. I mean, it's like a burn copy, but that has like more sentimental value. But and maybe a few others. But other than that, yeah, it's like I have all my movies, just about all my movies on my phone, between on my phone and on my computer. Sorry, David Lynch. I know you don't like people watching movies, but it makes my commute go a lot easier. So, yeah, I watch movies on my phone.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I saw your collection. I mean, essentially what I get the – I started really getting into movies just recently. I mean, I've always been searching for new, different movies that necessarily my friends weren't watching. But like, I didn't really get into it. Like, I would watch like David Lynch movies. I'd go out of the way to watch like when Eyes Wide Shut came out. I dragged my high school girlfriend to go see it. Like crap like that.
Right.
But I didn't really get, you know. And I saw I probably watched one Fellini movie and one Ingmar Bergman movie just so I could like know a little bit about movies.
Totally.
But I wasn't really into it. But I get the sense from seeing your collection that you've been really into it, you know, because I think you and I are a similar age. It mm-hmm. seems like you've been into it for a lot longer. And so you've already gone through that phase of I need to build up my I need to own all the DVDs of all my favorite directors.
Oh, totally.
You know, you already went through that phase, and so now you're like, okay, I got the stuff that I need, but it's also, you know, you've been a fan of movies for so long, it's like, all right, a little bit, it's been there, done that.
Yeah, and it's weird, like, if you told my, like, you know, 24, 25-year-old self that, I would have been like, no, you're crazy, but now it's like, I mean, every movie, I mean, it's crazy to think about, but every movie I own, I've watched a bunch of, I mean, I'm sure there's a small handful of movies I've only watched once, but it's like, especially at this point, because I've trimmed down my collection so much that, like, these are movies I've seen, like, a bunch of times, you know? So, I'm not that attached. I mean, if anything, I'll just be honest. It's cool just, like, to have them out when people come over. And it's just like, yeah. Oh, you've got movies. Like that's really... I mean, no, it's true. I mean, but as far as I go... Now I go to the theater, which I've been doing a lot in this past week. I've seen quite a few things this last week. And other than that, I just watch, like, reality TV with my fiance because she has me hooked on, like, all these, like, terrible but really, like, entertaining shows, so.
Oh, that's awesome. Did you go over to film at Lincoln Center? I know that they're doing, like, a 21st century movie thing where they're just putting out, they're just showing, like, they just showed Frownland.
Right.
La Cienega.
Yeah, no, so, oh, yeah, they're doing, like a double feature thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm contemplating going to, I might, I don't know, we'll see how I feel. Tomorrow, I know they're showing the Bruno Dumont, the sequel to Lil' Kin Kin, which I think that was the best movie of 2014, but he made a sequel with all the cast, and they're slightly grown up now called Coin Coin. I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong, but yeah, they're showing the whole full, it was like a mini series, so they're showing the whole thing. Starting at what it's going from like 2:30 to like 7 or 8 o'clock. It's like a whole series, so I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I love Bruno Dumont's one of my favorite current filmmakers. So, but I'm finding the older I get, I don't really like long movies, with a few exceptions. Yeah, like I'm gearing up to go back to Toronto in a little over a month. So what I usually do, because I've been going for almost a decade now, so like the whole month of August, I don't really go to the movies because I have to kind of like cleanse my palate and like condition myself, because it's like, you know, not so much anymore, but for the first half, the first few years I went, it was like, you know, 4 to 6 movies a day.
Yeah.
But the more you go, once you become a vet, it's like, you know, by like day 4 or day 5, all the movies start to bleed in together and you feel like you're watching one long movie. So now... I try to take it easy, and, you know, usually the schedule, it's like now it's just like 2 to 3 movies spread out for like a whole day, and you get to, you know, kind of relax and not just go from one theater to the next. But yeah, I've been seeing some interesting stuff recently. I saw Midsommar which was fine. I saw the new Spider-Man movie. I saw The Souvenir, which I think that's next to High Life. It's probably my favorite movie of the year.
Did you see any of the other Joanna Hogg movies? Criterion Channel has... What is it? It's Unrelated.
Yeah, there's Unrelated, and I don't know how to pronounce the other one, but all the Tom Hiddleston stuff. But I've only seen those movies when they first came out. Like, I haven't revisited them since. So prior to last weekend, 2013 was the last time I saw one of her films. But now I just want to go back and revisit them all. But this one was so good, though. Like, it was really, really, really good.
So speaking of, this is my attempt at like a smooth segue. So speaking of, only watching your movies on streaming and watching them at the movie theater or at film festival. So Velvet Buzzsaw,
right?
That was a really interesting release because it came out at Sundance, but they almost simultaneously came out on Netflix. Originally, I think it was supposed to come out at this like the same day as the premiere. Mm-hmm. But then I think that Netflix pushed it back a couple of days. Right. But whatever. The point is that basically while the big Sundance premiere was going on, they released it on Netflix almost immediately. And so that the release of the format was definitely – this is very relevant to Velvet Buzzsaw. So I was in Sundance when that was happening, and it was funny because essentially my entire house was the house of people that I went with. We were like, well, if it's on Netflix, I guess we don't have to, because I wasn't there when the celebrities are there. We always go the second week when all the celebrities leave. Mm-hmm. And so we're just going for the movies. We're not going for like all the crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're like, look, why would we see Velvet Buzzsaw for $20 when we can watch it on Netflix as soon as we go home? So it was an interesting way to roll it out. But of course, you know, if you were there during the first week, it was like Jake Gyllenhaal was there, Dan Gilroy was there. It was kind of Rene Russo. It was kind of like a big event to go see the movie because they would be there. But after that, it's like whatever.
Right.
Did you see Velvet Buzzsaw like right when it came out on Netflix?
I did. I mean, that weekend, I was on a Saturday. Yeah. The first weekend it got released from Netflix. Yeah, me and my fiance watched it. Yeah.
So, I didn't realize that because the whole reason why we're doing this episode. So, I'll have you introduce yourself in a little bit, but first. So the episode is going to be about Velvet Buzzsaw and Nightcrawler. Now that's out of order chronologically, but
right. You
wrote an essay online on pinlandempire.com
right. About
Velvet Buzzsaw. But it's interesting because when you were you and I talked about it this summer, and you're like, it was one of the things I'm most proud of writing. I want to do, you know, I want a podcast about it.
Sure.
And I had in my head then that you had written it recently, but actually you had written it, you know, probably right after shortly after you watched the movie back in February. So
it was it was like soon after, yeah.
So why is it that you've been thinking about the essay? What is it about Velvet Buzzsaw or like some of the stuff that you wrote about it that was on the forefront of your mind like this summer at the barbecue?
Well, it's two things. Well, because still recently everyone I'm not on Instagram, but between Facebook and Twitter, I still get like you said, yeah, I wrote this back in the winter, but still, I still get a like or a retweet or a comment or a DM about what I wrote about Velvet Buzzsaw. And it's like, oh, wow, that's kind of cool that it still resonates with. And this is without, this isn't like ego or patting myself on the back, but it's just like, of anything that I've written this year so far, this is, and I'm not talking about the things I do on my site where I compare things. I'm talking just like a straight, like, written review. This is a thing that, I guess has resonated with most folks, and it makes sense because it got me to go back to read it because I shared it, and then I started getting good, you know, like comments and feedback about it. I was like, oh, people really like this, and then I reread it back, and it's just like what I wrote, which obviously has to do with what happens in the movie. It really does resonate with the now, just about people who are just like tastemakers and criticism, and just like the power that a lot of folks have, especially on Twitter. for example, a lot of stuff that I wrote about, you know, it's so funny. So I didn't name names, but like there's a section in the part in the thing that I wrote on Velvet Buzzsaw about people who just coin themselves tastemakers and really just think that their opinion is more important than, you know, and anything. And it's funny because a couple of those people, it's so weird. Back in February, those specific people who I had in mind were kind of acting up this week on Twitter and were getting all this attention, saying stuff either about Martin Scorsese or saying things about Quentin Tarantino, who I'm not even really a fan of, but a stupid comment or a stupid hot take on someone is still a stupid hot take. And sometimes, you know, it really annoys me. So I had to kind of like chime in. So it's so funny. I'm not going to say their names now, but it's just like these kind of people who've been put on a pedestal partially by themselves and just by like mindless followers who just, you know, blindly trust and agree with people who have checks on Twitter. It's just so funny that months later after I wrote this, they're doing exactly kind of what I was criticizing and talking about in what I wrote about Velvet Buzzsaw, which happens in the actual movie because the main character, Jake Gyllenhaal, he's a critic. He's an art critic in the film. And what struck me so much is that like through, you know, so much you kind of get you understand that he's like a long form film critic. And it's like between like podcasts and like, you know, quick little blurby critics, you know, like the whole idea of like a long form written piece, it will never die. And I don't even want to say it's dying, but it's definitely not as popular as like it once was. You know what I mean? So I appreciate, you know, in 2019 folks who still do that. Because there's some, I mean, you know, anyone can just do 400 words on just like, I thought this movie was good because, I thought it was bad because. But if you get really like weave in and out of personal stuff and like digress, but then bring it back to the center, I just like when people do that, specifically in the written form, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so it's interesting, Marcus. You are one of the few reasons why I'm even on Twitter. Like, film Twitter, to some extent, is just so. It's really harsh. It's really grating. And even people that you know, they're wickedly funny and intelligent. It's just some of the stuff that comes out. It's like everybody needs to score points one way or the other. And it's like It like hurts me a little bit every single time I go on film Twitter. With that being said, like I have to go on it. You, Dave Eves, you know, Wrong Reel, and the people. Excuse me.
Yeah.
You, Dave Eves, Wrong Reel, the people around Wrong Reel, James, etc.
Sure.
Like you guys are people that I want to stay in touch with and want to like know what's going on. And you guys are really more in the Twitter space than you are in, like, my Facebook groups, for instance. And right. So it's a small core group of people that keep me on Twitter. And then everybody else around it, it's sort of like, yeah, sometimes it does feel like I'm in the middle of Velvet Buzzsaw and not in a good way.
It's true. And it's funny you say, because I have to admit myself, like, and it all, we're all human, and it just depends on, like, what side of the bed I wake up on. I'll never start anything with anybody on film Twitter. But sometimes, like, when I just see these, like, prolific statements made by people, and it's just, like, opinions are one thing, but then it's just, like, that's not even true. Like, sometimes, like, this is the first movie to do this, or it's just, like, there's no other movie to do this way. And it's, like, that's literally not true. And then I get in the... This is when the creepy part comes in. It's, like, I'll track down the person who, like, made this tweet or made this post, and then you start to find, it's like, oh, you're 24 years old, and it's like, you haven't seen a lot of stuff, which is fine, because at 24, I didn't see a lot of stuff, but the difference is, it's like, we all have moments where we fall flat on our face, but it's just like, you know, and we think we know it all, especially when we're 24 and 25, but it's just like, you know, just, I don't know, do your research, and especially now, there's no excuse to not just Google, like, hey, what was the first movie to use this filming technique, or what was the first movie to deal with this subject matter? Like, all of it's on the internet, and even if like certain information is incorrect, you can still get close. But like, nothing is the first anything in like the 1970s, or even, you know, like recently. Like, it becomes this weird rabbit hole. Like, a lot of so like within film Twitter. So last year, this young guy wrote this article for Vice UK about Happy Death Day to You, and the title, it has since changed because they got shitted on, as they should have, but the title was Happy Death Day to You is the first slasher film to deal with grief. And it's just like, what? A movie that came out in 2000, when, I don't know when that movie came out, 2017, 2018, like, that's the first slasher movie? So then so people started mocking it, and then to this day, I still, because it just still boggles my mind. So, like, I wrote, I jokingly, what did I write? I was like, some recent movie, I was like, you know, so-and-so is the first movie to deal with grief. And then a lot of people got it as a joke, but then some people took it serious, and it's not so much that they took it serious and was like, you're wrong. What are you talking about? They were just like, I'm pretty sure Hereditary did that first. And it's like, Hereditary came out. Hereditary is a recent movie. And it's not even, it's not a slasher movie. And two, it's like, you know, and then it just becomes this crazy, like, web of, like, craziness. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it all just comes back to just, like, no one can know everything. Although I do sometimes get a hint of certain people on film Twitter. They want to be, they act like know-it-alls, you know what I'm saying? Like, I get comments all the time about, oh, Marcus, your film knowledge is great, your film knowledge, and it's like, I'll be the first to tell you, it's like, Westerns, like, obviously, I've seen a lot of Westerns, I've seen a lot of cowboy movies, but I don't know, like, John Ford's filmography, or John Wayne, I don't know any, and like, I don't know a lot of that stuff, or, like, Giallo films, like, my knowledge of, like, the Giallo genre, it's very basic, like, Mario Bava, Dario Argento, and it just kind of stops there. You know what I'm saying? So I just wish more people would do research, because it's always rooted in the fact that sometimes things can be rewritten, and, like, how do I articulate? Like, history can be rewritten falsely, and I just have a personal issue with that. I'm just I've been told by a lot of people I'm very literal minded, so it's just it's like facts are facts, and the next thing you know, someone who actually did something will be discredited, and the next thing you know, the wrong person will get credit for something. I'm really big into, like, I'm big into that also, like, credit, give credit to those who deserve it, and, you know, it's all kind of rooted in that, I guess.
So that came up for me actually when I was doing research on Velvet Buzzsaw.
Mm-hmm.
I read this article, which actually was a deeply insightful and thoughtful article that I felt this guy got the movie. He sort of understood what was going on. I'm not saying he necessarily articulated it the best way, but I was like, okay, this guy understands some of the stuff that I'm seeing in the same movie. That's really cool. I want to read the rest of it.
Right.
But then at the end of the article, he writes, oh, there's only one mention of Polly in the entire movie. The, what's her name? Rosanna Hayes, the Rene Russo character, her, she had a band member that, by the way, everybody, this is not going to be a spoiler-free episode. We are going a deep dive on two movies have been. I mean, Velvet Buzzsaw is on Netflix. So at this point,
Nightcrawler has been out for years. It's been out for, like, almost, 2014. Holy, time is really.
Yeah, 2014.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
And it was a big deal when it came out. It had a lot of awards buzz around it, and
then nothing.
The commercials were everywhere.
Yeah.
So people should have seen these movies by now, and if you haven't, stop the episode, go listen to it so you can hear Marcus talk about it.
Right.
But when I'm reading this article, like I said, very thoughtful article. I feel like the guy really got the themes and had some interesting things to say. And so I continue reading the article, and then at the end of it, he says, yeah, Polly is only mentioned once at the end of the episode, the band member that had died that was a member of Hayes's punk band in 1983. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, that's not correct. He was mentioned when, I don't know how you say his name. I think it's David Diggs.
Oh, David. Yeah.
David Diggs. Yeah.
Yeah.
When David Diggs is talking to Hayes outside of the party, they have a long conversation about Polly.
Yeah. When he's I liked your early stuff and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is actually kind of great. But there's a part of me that's like, wait, this is on Netflix. You literally just could have rewinded the movie and checked to see if Polly had been mentioned any other time.
Yeah.
So it kind of, and I kind of knew that we were going to talk a little bit, because I know that your essay, part of it is about the importance of long form writing, doing research. And I know that this is something that has bothered you a little bit, you know, from that. I mean, that one about the first slasher film to deal with, was it first slasher film or was it first horror film? How did
slasher first? It doesn't matter, okay. But it was slasher film to deal with grief. And it's like one. I mean, pretty much all to some abstract. Not even abstract. Like most slasher films deal with grief because someone that the main character loved was probably murdered, and they're grieving that death. So just by you know what I mean. So yeah.
Yeah. No. It's a. It's really funny, the funny thing too is that Hereditary comment, while also being wrong in several different ways, also sort of highlights how wrong this argument is, and that there are even recent examples not too long ago.
Yeah, just like a year ago. Exactly.
So it's pretty funny. And so, okay, so before we get more into the movie, and we definitely need to get into Velvet Buzzsaw as soon as possible, just let people know who you are and some of the, like we were talking about pinandlampire.com and your essay.
Sure. I run the film site, blog, film journal, whatever you want to call it, Pinland Empire. It's pinandlempire.com. I co-host a podcast with my friend Scott Thurow. He's a film score composer. It's called Zebras in America. Although I've been on the podcast a bunch. I'm what's considered the third mic to the Pink Smoke. John Cribbs and Chris Funderburg, they run this film site, a long form writing film site called the Pink Smoke. I'm on Wrong Reel a lot, all the time. I'm on FlixWise with Martin Kessler a lot, all the time. I'm always doing some podcast with my friend Bradley Cornish for Dinner with Lynch. I'm always doing something movie related. But if you just go to PinlandEmpire.com, that's usually the hub of anything that I do inside or outside of Pinland Empire. So.
I was trying to remember where the first podcast episode was that I heard you. It was either Wrong Reel or FlixWise, and I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But me and my friends, I'd say Zebras in America is the podcast that me and my friends talk about the most.
Oh, no way. Nice. Yeah,
I really enjoy the format. I enjoy like the very conversational. Clearly you and Scott have a great relationship, and so it's so great to listen to. I feel like I'm in a conversation with you. It actually feels like, it's funny because I know you're a similar age to me, but it feels like I'm listening to the cool kids in the neighborhood talk about stuff, and I'm like, oh crap, I gotta write that down. I just watched like 5 Claire Denis movies. I still haven't seen Freddy Gets Fingered though.
Oh, it's not going anywhere. Well, the next time we link up, you can have my DVD. I've seen it so many times. So, the Claire Denis thing is more like, I always, no matter what I do at the end of the day, my movie. Oh, I guess I didn't even mention. I guess my big thing, I do a lot of movie comparisons. What was I gonna say? The biggest thing that always makes me happy, it's usually three things, and someone will always tweet at me or let me know that like, they've got into Claire Denis films, or they watch Post Tenebris Lux, or they watch the movie Fear X because of me. Those are kind of like those three things, which happen, semi-regularly these days, are always just like, oh, good. I turned someone on to like some of my favorite, cinematic things. So that's always good.
So with these two movies, Velvet Buzzsaw and Nightcrawler, have you done any side-by-sides? There was one in particular that I feel like you had done, or if you haven't, you've done enough similar to it. There was a Persona shot in Velvet Buzzsaw. Did you do that as a side-by-side?
While we're talking, I'll say, like, it honestly, I have a folder of like so many that I haven't posted. I do like, 7 to 10 a day, but
yeah.
Persona and Velvet Buzzsaw. Let's see. I've done a bunch of comparisons, but not let's see. Oops, I spelled Persona wrong. I don't think so. Which
there's
scene?
There's a scene where Malkovich reaches out to one of Vetrel Dease's paintings.
Oh, someone. Oh, looks like someone else did. Oh,
No.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's that famous person. Oh, wait. Oh, no. A lot of people did it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so I'm glad I didn't. Okay, good.
Well, the one...
Oh, a bunch... Oh, yeah, I'm scrolling. Yeah, a bunch of people have done that. Okay.
There's a funny side-by-side that I literally tag you... I tagged you in it because I was like, oh, I need Marcus to see that I did this. And then you had done it, I think, an hour beforehand. It was that great one when Roger Stone, the picture leaked of his back tattoos of Richard Nixon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You wrote that. You're like, damn, I just did that. Yeah, right.
I actually tagged you in it and then had the... Fortunately, I went back and actually looked at your website. And you had posted... Because the pictures were... I clipped them. I didn't have them... I didn't get them from a GIF or anything. I literally just cut them out from something on Google Images. And they matched up basically exactly the same as yours. I definitely would have looked... Like I was stealing from you, so I was glad I checked. It was pretty funny though.
Oh yeah, all good. Yeah, I have a few. One in particular that I just made recent because I knew we were doing this, but I'll just say whenever this goes up, I'll just say it's a comparison between Velvet Buzzsaw, a really really old silent film that's kind of a. Similar subject matter, the portrait. It's about a haunted painting. So
So I guess we should. I guess now that we're far enough into the episode, I guess we should actually mention a little bit about the movie. Do you want to talk a little bit about what actually happens in Velvet Buzzsaw?
Sure. I mean, and we've said quite a bit about it already. But yeah, no, Velvet Buzzsaw. I mean, on a surface level. You know, it's just a movie about the art world, specifically the modern art world. And this art gallery comes into the possession of these really, I mean, it's all subjective, but within the world of the movie, we're led to believe that these pieces of art, which are pretty good, are really great, like, you know, works by this mysterious guy with, like, no name and, like, you know... No information about this guy. He just dies he doesn't leave all his paintings behind, but like his artwork is discovered. And then, you know, the people who work for this art gallery are kind of like, hey, we should, you know, we can make a lot of money off this. This is really good. And everyone who kind of comes into this art's possession is kind of is hypnotized a little bit. And then, you know, one by one, you know, when people come in contact with it, like certain pieces of art, not even necessarily this mysterious guy's, but like other pieces of art kind of come to life and murder people. And Jake Gyllenhaal plays this art critic he's this powerful art critic that people kind of like cater to. Renee Russo, she's the head of this art gallery. David Diggs, he's this like up and coming, you know, artist. John Malkovich plays this kind of like older veteran modern artist. And it takes place, it's set during Art Basel, right?
Yeah, the first part is in Miami. Yeah. Yeah. And then right, they go back to LA where they all live.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I was thinking, man, Gilroy has like a penchant for names, dude. I mean, the names in this movie are Vetrel Dease. Is the artist,
yeah,
Morph
yeah.
Van de Walt.
yeah.
Rodera Hayes, that's a pretty cool name. The artists are Pierce and Damrish. And then I love the competing art dealer's name, John Don Don.
yeah.
it's a little bit over the top. He's clearly having fun.
And that's another thing that I put in my movie too, is that Dan Gilroy teeters the line of like making fun of and parodying modern art, but at the same time he does show it respect. Whereas like a lot of movies, I mean, essentially Velvet Buzzsaw is a dark comedy, but a lot of comedies that make fun of modern art make the art really bad.
Yeah.
Like on purpose, just to add to the comedic effect. But here, you know, Vetrel Dease, his artwork is, the paintings are, you know, they're really cool. Another artwork that we see throughout the movie is really cool. But then there's also like silly art that we're supposed to like think is ridiculous and laugh at. Like the mannequin.
The robot. Hobo man.
Yeah, yeah, we're so, Robo Man, yeah, like that's you know, we're supposed to kind of get a laugh out of that too. But I think that's another thing that I liked about this movie, is that it's weird. It's so, like, two examples. So if you take a movie like Junebug, which also, you know, that's more like a dramedy, but it's still a comedy. The art in that movie is really good. I think. But then a movie like Art School Confidential, which I'm sure we'll speak on that too, because the plot is very similar to Velvet Buzzsaw, whereas, like, the art in Art School Confidential, for the most part, it's all silly. It's like, you know, when you think of modern art, it's like it's a hammer hanging from a string wrapped in Band-Aids, like that kind of stuff, you know, which, and I'm sure that existed, you know, especially in New York City in the late 70s, early 80s. But this movie kind of takes from both of those, and it's just like, no, there's actually some good modern art, but then there's also some silly modern art. You know what I'm saying? So I really like that.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. You can tell Zwigoff definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's interesting because Zwigoff is obviously somebody who makes a lot of art and is surrounded by artists. But his making fun of art is definitely, like, a lot more aggressive than Gilroy. It's interesting because... Yeah, the artists in the movie are taken seriously, right? Like, both Piers and Damrosch are taken very seriously. But yeah, even the people who are clearly ridiculous, even the people who are clearly a part of the problem, are part of the system, you know, the art dealers, Morph, they still clearly are passionate about art. Like, yes, they are exactly a part of selling it, and they're a part of the bullshit. And they're, you know, that's what you spend most of your time focused on. But you realize, like, Morph is deadly serious about the stuff that he writes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Rodera is, you know, she supports Damrosch. I mean, there's one point where she essentially says, you know, I'll give you this art, you know, even though everybody wants to buy it, I'll sell it to you. But you have to support Damrosch, this new up and coming artist that I'm a fan of. Yeah, she stands to make a ton of money off of it, but she genuinely is trying to support art in her very, like, feeble sort of messed up way.
And I don't know how, well, I guess it is messed up, but it's like any art or any business dealing, that's kind of how it works. It's like, hey, do me a favor, put this person on, and then I'll help you out, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's obviously a universal thing outside of just the art world, you know?
Well, that wasn't her messed up part. Her messed up part is when she had Morph's boyfriend sell her. Yeah, it is Morph. Morph's boyfriend is, like, selling her information behind her back. And then the way that she strong arms... what is that? Philippa, the woman who discovers Vetrel Dease's artwork, discovers, you know. Yeah. But that's another interesting thing too, right? Because in the movie, we're made to believe that, oh, because this woman, Vetrel Dease, wanted all of his art destroyed, and this woman came and, like, is sort of exploiting it for her own benefit. Right. One, she's genuinely hypnotized by the work, as you mentioned, everybody is hypnotized by the work. Yeah. From, like, people who are totally full of it, all the way up to, like, the best artists. They see it and they're inspired to create, or they're, like, humbled in front of it. Mm-hmm. So the art is clearly supposed to be hypnotic, but it's like, at the same time, we're supposed to believe that because she sort of steals the artwork, even though it's supposed to be destroyed. But, like, throughout the history of, like, there's so many stories of people saying, destroy all of my art. Like, Franz Kafka, I think, is the most famous one, where he's like, destroy all of my writings. And his buddy is like, yeah, not a chance. And that's where we got all of Franz Kafka from. Like, there were so many stories of that. So it feels like this movie, like you said, this isn't just, it is definitely absurd. Any of the, like, all of the kills are absurd and over the top, and, you know, most of them could be, like, seen as silly or humorous. But actually, when it comes to, like, people's actions, there's a lot of ambiguity, or, like, I could see it going both ways for most of the stuff that people do.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. Is there anybody in this movie that has... I mean, I guess the artists have some integrity, right? Like, Piers going... Does anybody in this movie have integrity?
Absolutely. I'm forgetting some of the names, but like even a guy like John Malkovich's character, there's one scene where he has a piece of his art out and the guy comes in, you know, to look at it. And then at one point John Malkovich feels like he's being bullshitted. And he's just like, just tell me if you think it's good or not. You know what I mean? Like his character, you know, and again, like David Diggs's character, he has, because it seems like he's kind of leaving. Actually, oh yeah, I guess there's that underlying story. Like he's kind of so like selling out to some degree. Like he's leaving his like grassroots art collective to go, be represented by Rene Russo. So I guess John Malkovich's character is kind of the only guy like who sticks out to me that has any kind of integrity of any of the main characters.
Yeah, but of course David Diggs eventually he goes back. That's the ending for him. So the two guess the three people that don't get consumed by art, like actually killed by art, are the two artists.
Right.
Because Malkovich, he ends up like going off and, you know, freaking doodling on the sand.
Yeah.
So he's literally making art like just for himself, and it's going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really enjoyed that ending. But then David Diggs, yeah, he actually goes back to the collective. He's like,
that's right.
To Radera Hayes, he's like, is it Radera Hayes? Because he starts dating that woman, and he's like, yeah, I'm not going back. I need to be myself.
Yeah.
And then that woman, Rococo, the little girl, she somehow makes it out too, although just barely. Because she keeps on showing up and finding everybody dead, and she always has Starbucks with her. Which, by the way, is one of the most horrifying visuals in the movie, is that everybody constantly has Starbucks right when something really bad is about to happen.
Exactly. Also, it's like, I took that as a metaphor of, like, their coffee is just not good to me. So there's that. Also, because that's one of those little details that always sticks out in movies. It's like, why are you could, there's so much. I mean, I get that, like, when things are trendy, but it's like, it's just such bitter coffee. Like, I'm sure there's so many other options, especially in Los Angeles. Like, I'm sure there's a much better option than Starbucks. It's like in New York City, all the different, like, just like Manhattan or Brooklyn alone, it's like all the choices you have and like you're going to Starbucks. I don't know.
But, I felt really bad because I heard you guys talking about sandwiches and you were like, why would anybody ever go to Subway? And I literally like had just gone to Subway and gotten like a rib sub. So
I had to change.
I stopped going after that. I'm like, oh, I guess I'm not supposed to do that now that I'm in New York City.
Yeah, and not for nothing, man. Even like bodega sandwiches taste a little better, in my opinion, than Subway, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, so watching this movie for me, both this and Nightcrawler give me, you know how there's certain movies, or maybe this is just me, but there's certain movies that I watch that make me feel sort of sick, like sick about the human condition, like, ugh, people are gross. Like, I'm gross, everybody else is gross. This movie sort of does that to me. But it does it to me in a very specific way where it's like, yep, death is inescapable. Nothing we do can change it, no matter how much art we make, you know, at the very best of it, or how much money we get, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's all going to end, and it's probably, you know, it might end nasty.
This movie definitely left
that sheen on me.
No, it's funny you say that because that's more the feeling I had with Nightcrawler, where it's like, you're obviously not wrong when it comes to Velvet Buzzsaw. I just think because at the end of the day, it's a dark comedy, keyword comedy, that it's a little lighter, whereas like Nightcrawler, it's just like, oh, well, Jesus, like, goddamn. Like that movie left me a little stunned, where it's just like, human beings and just like, just this whole idea of like drive sometimes doesn't always have the best outcome. Cause Jake Gyllenhaal's character in Nightcrawler, he had a lot of drive. He was very determined. He didn't give up all this, but it's like the final outcome. It's just like, you know, like he lets people die in the movie. You know what I mean? He causes deaths. He kills people. Like and he essentially, like, without delving too deep, he's like, I'm using air quotes, he's like the hero of the movie. I mean, he's the protagonist, which, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean we have to root and cheer for him. But there is this weird kind of tone where it's just like, well, the bad guy won, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've heard Gilroy talk about this a couple of times. He's like, I wanted to make the movie about the guy winning. I wanted it to be an American success story.
Which happens so much. Like, that is an American, just screwing people over.
Yeah.
Which is an understatement in the case of Nightcrawler. But that's what happens a lot. It's not always like, but then at the same time, you know, like, as I'm talking, like, I'm conflicted, because it's one of those things where, like, look, killing people and just watching people die, like, you're a terrible human being. But it's also, there's this myth of, like, if you're, like, a lower income or if you're poor, all you have to do is just work, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and you'll just succeed. And that's kind of a bullshit story that gets fed a lot. So let me choose my words carefully. Outside of the terrible things that Jake Gyllenhaal did in that movie, it's like, if like a poor person, you know, like he was struggling, like, wins in the end, it's like, more power to you. Like, I'm speaking, you know, generally. Like, that's why like in college, like, all the CKY jackass people, I was just like, I don't necessarily like that stuff, but it's like, those guys really won to some degree just for being stupid and being themselves. Like they weren't working hard. I'm always kind of fascinated by people who, like, don't have to work hard and make it to some degree. And not people who are already in established, you know, position. So not like a Paris Hilton or a Nicole Richie or a Kardashian, like, their lives and generations after them, they're already set. But just like regular people who don't really do much and just get famous, popular, and rich, I'm kind of like, you know what? I respect that. And that comes from, like, you know, I did the traditional route of just, like, right after college, I went into the workforce, wasn't making a lot of money. So I don't necessarily want to always knock someone for, you know, but that's my own personal thing.
Well, no, it's funny because Lou Bloom, he, at the beginning, he is trying to go the traditional route, right? Like, he is hustling, he's going and he's stealing chain link fence, which is, like, talk about petty crime. I mean, clearly you have to be in a tough spot to be stealing chain link fence and selling it.
Yeah, but the thing from the start of that movie, though, we know something is up. Only because it's like, because he, I guess it's not. I mean, I went back and rewatched *Philip the Bus*. I didn't watch rewatch *Nightcrawler*. But what I do remember, I know, doesn't he, like, he attacks a security guard?
Yeah, but in between that, you're right. He attacks the security guard.
It's at the start of the movie,
yeah. Yeah, he attacks the security guard. So you already know there's something off about him. And he does it for, like, a watch. And it probably isn't a particularly expensive watch, but he's like, I don't have a watch, so I'm going to take that watch.
Yeah.
But then he goes and he sells the copper, and he sells the manhole covers, and he sells all the crap that he's stolen to a construction foreman. And then at the end of it, he says, can I work for you? The guy's like, no. And then he's like, what if I work for you for free as an intern? I'm a fast learner. And so clearly you see, like, the guy is genuinely trying to hustle and trying to do things the right way.
Very true.
Or he's just trying to do things the traditional route. I don't think he cares about doing it the right way. And the guy just looks at him. He says, no, I don't want to hire a thief. Now, this is a guy who had just bought from him.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's
clearly
exactly the same type of character.
Yes. Yep.
As the person who he's so, like, casually putting down.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's sort of where it begins. But then this movie also has an obsession with death. So, like, if you were to think of Dan Gilroy as an auteur with these two films, I haven't seen Roman J. Israel, so I do have no idea if that movie fits in with the themes that I've seen in these two movies.
Oh, but, like, wait, he directed that?
Yeah, I think so.
An idiot. Oh my god. I mean, it kind of ties in. It definitely, and it's not just because of the reuse of some of the same actors, but I just feel like I'm big into, like, you know, this isn't just Marvel or DC, but cinematic universes. So, like, I feel like at the same time that all the Velvet Buzzsaw stuff is happening, just across L.A., the story of Nightcrawler is happening.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, oh, man, I saw Roman J. Israel in the theater, and I'm usually... Hold on, let me... Oh, yeah, and Gilroy, Jesus, wow. I was not paying attention to that.
So, but what this movie has in common, the two of them, is like the connection between art and death. And obviously there's a connection between commerce and capitalism and art, and that's discussed, and it is not a pretty picture. Yeah. But there's also, like, even more viscerally, and I think I sort of glanced over it the first time, I read this book, Denial of Death, or to be more accurate, I read, like, the first chapter, which was a summary of the book. But after that, it's like, I don't know if I want to read this whole thing. But the idea of it being that it isn't just love and sex and, like, the good stuff that makes us, motivates us to do stuff. It's also, like, it's also the bad stuff that motivates us to do stuff. Fear of death or whatever, like, you're trying to ignore it. Point is, like, Jake Gyllenhaal, like, Lou Bloom gets his break when he pulls over on the side of the road when there's, like, a deadly crash.
Yeah, right.
Who the hell pulls over on the side of the, like, I get it. People slow down sometimes. I was never one of those people. I don't want to see.
Oh, God, don't even get me started. I'm always like, I have somewhere to go. Like, just go. Like, I'm all, and when I'm in my, I'm like, just go. But yeah, but anyway. Yeah.
So I'm not a rubbernecker, but I understand the human desire to rubberneck. Like, sometimes you just can't look away. I get it.
Yeah.
But nobody frickin' stops their car to, like, get out and creep around a car crash.
Well, see, I have to question that because I think that movie came out at a perfect time because well, I guess you weren't living. I mean, it's happened before, but it usually always seems to happen in New York. I guess you weren't living here at the time, but in 2013, or maybe it was the same year, maybe it was in 2014. There was this like famous cover story on the New York. Well, it was on all the New York newspapers. There was a scuffle. These two guys were like fighting, and then this one guy got pushed onto the train track. This was before the train came, and he was, like, too short, so he couldn't lift himself up. And instead of anyone helping him, they all took their cameras out and, like, filmed it.
Oh.
Yeah, it was all – and it's this, like, crazy – it's this, like, iconic image of, like, just before the train comes, it's this guy, like, hey, help me. And it's just, like, a couple of people with their phones filming it. And it's just, like, whoa. So that's why – so it's kind of, like, I don't know. So some people do – And there's also the debate of, like, could they have done anything? Maybe not, but at least make an effort to try to pull the guy instead of, like, taking your phone out and filming a death. But I think that fascination, I mean, the motivations are different. Like, Jake Gyllenhaal's motivation in Nightcrawler we're talking about, or Lou, rather. Yeah, Lou, film all this stuff. He just wants to get ahead, and he knows this is what people like, TMZ, blah, blah, blah. But he's feeding off of that, you know, at the core, you know, before when we were kids, maybe I think before we were even born, there was like, you know, Faces of Death came out.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then even before Faces of Death, there was always like these myths of like, hey, do snuff films exist? Got to, you know, seek it out. So it's like there's always that desire. And I think with technology, specifically smartphones, that desire has gotten like worse and worse and worse, like just from World Star Hip Hop to TMZ to fight video compilations. It's just all like there's a whole rabbit hole of like Chuck E. Cheese, like parents fighting at Chuck E. Cheese's like all over the country. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
And I've watched them all because it's like, and not even like, oh, this is so cool. It's just like, holy shit. It's like it's a Chuck E. Cheese. But, you know, they also serve beer at Chuck E. Cheese. That's kind of part of the problem. Excuse me. Problem.
Yeah, no, and I mean, this movie came out in 2014, so the news was already pretty messed up at that point. They already had, you know, Fox News had already taken its turn a decade before.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, but like there are definite, but the news has even more become this weird, crazy feedback loop of like, oh, you guys are addicted to rage and paranoia. Okay, here's some more rage and paranoia. Watch our show.
Yeah.
And that crazy feedback loop has just gotten worse and worse and worse. And it's funny because in the movie you sort of get the sense, and this is part of the horror of this movie, is that you get the sense that like Lou is not just going to be a guy selling videos. Lou says right in the movie, like, I want to be the guy that owns the I don't want to be on camera. I want to own the station and I want to own the video, like the cameras that shoot the video. I want to own the whole thing. And you get the sense by the end of it, like, yeah, in 5 years, in 2019, that guy is Roger Ailes. Like, in 2019, that guy is running, you know, like a string of crazy news stations. So,
Yeah. Or even like a lesser example. I mean,
Sinclair.
Again,
that's the station I was thinking of. The Sinclair.
Right.
Network.
Right. But like a guy like, you know, may he rest in peace, but Q, the guy who started World Star Hip Hop, it's almost identical to like a guy like Lou. He was just some guy. And then like he was like filming fights himself. And then like people would send him stuff. And then like he lit like World Star. It's like it's a part of pop culture. He became a mogul. He became a millionaire. And people, World Star, like people say that. You know what I mean? So it's a very similar. I almost forgot. Bum fights. The mid 2000s, the early 2000s. That was another thing. Like, there's always that crazy fascination with, you know, I'm not trying to get on a high horse, but that was my all right, no, I'm not, because like I went to college between the years of 1999 through 2004. So like, you know, we're talking like Kazaa, Napster, when you would like download like messed up like videos and stuff. But then with the bum fights, when did I, like around 2002, 2003, that's kind of when I drew the line. It was just like, no, this isn't, and like these guys should, if any, like these guys need to be horsewhipped, honestly. I know that sounds really graphic, but like the guys behind bum fights are the worst human beings in the fucking in the world. But anyway,
no, absolutely. Oh gosh. So Lou has, there are two like super interesting things about Lou's character and some of the stuff that goes on. One of them is his relationship with his ride along buddy. What's interesting about that is in some ways that's his only like real human relationship. And it is totally an abusive, exploitative relationship even before we get to the ending.
Right. Oh, definitely.
It's like it's a totally messed up relationship, but that also for him was his most, and it also makes you question a little bit about what's going on with Lou. Like, why is he the way that he is? Because when he first interviews the guy as his intern, so the tables have turned a little bit. Instead of him asking to be the intern, he's asking somebody else to be his intern, totally hustling. But then he says to him, he's like, so what do? You turn tricks? It was like, what? And the guy's like, no, I'm straight. He's like, yeah, that's not what I asked you. and so it's like, wait, so what exactly has Lou been up to in these years before we run into him, you know, stealing chain link fence?
That, like, you can only, you can only imagine. Just, yeah, exactly. Just, yeah, say no more. And I think that's the implication, though, like, You never know, you know? So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then, oh gosh. And then the other thing that's really interesting is that Lou is an artist. Like, Lou is so in love with the technical aspects of making these videos. It isn't just that, yes, he's driven and he's ambitious. And he would beat up an innocent child to get his way in whatever field he was in. But he chose this field because, like, this is sort of what, like, he loves this. Yeah, he loves the lone, like, wolf. You know, I think Jake Gyllenhaal said coyote. Like, he imagined him as a coyote at night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's that nocturnal predator or the nocturnal, you know, carrion bird or whatever. But, yeah, no, so he's doing all this stuff. He likes to – but at the same time, he also really gets into – you know, the wide angles and, oh, no, stand over there and, oh, I need to get this footage. And he starts actually posing bodies. He starts, like, dragging bodies so he can frame the shot better. He's in love with, like, he's making his art.
Yeah.
And it's kind of wild to see that or to think about it that way. And I definitely didn't notice it the first time, but as I'm watching it now, particularly after watching Velvet Buzzsaw, it's that weird relationship between, like, this totally messed up guy and the fact that he is actually pursuing an art form of some, and in fact, the art form that freaking Dan Gilroy and the people making this movie are pursuing.
Exactly. And he's got this, like, and it's not just his character, but like when he's filming stuff in Nightcrawler, it's like his body language is so intense. He's so focused and tunnel vision. Yeah, it's like a painter in the zone or like a sculptor in the zone. Like, don't disturb me right now. I'm in the middle of, I'm in the middle of creating, which is crazy. I never thought about it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that jumped out at me at first, I know it jumped out at me the first time I watched it, but I totally forgot about it. So there's lots of stuff about class and about like the messed up thing that consumers like the idea that everybody watches the news to get information, but yet there's only like half a minute of information, but there's like 6 minutes per episode of car crashes, crime, murder, sexual assault, you know, that whole idea. But the thing that jumped out at me that I had like blocked out or forgotten was the racial stuff in the movie, where basically they say like, you know, I only want crimes that happen in these good neighborhoods because the stuff that's happening in the bad neighborhoods, nobody wants to hear about.
It's true. Yeah, that's how people think. Yeah.
And then the flip side of it being when there's a house invasion on the rich side of town, they're like, oh, wow, this is a crazy story. It's a nice house and there's a house invasion. But then when they realize it isn't urban crime sneaking into the suburbs, it's actually these were drug dealers.
Yeah.
You know, more capitalism stuff. Like these are people making money. Then they're like, yeah, no, we're not going to tell that story. That isn't the story that we want to tell. We'll release it. We'll release it later.
Yeah. Wow.
This movie definitely leaves a sick feeling on me. It's weird. I felt like this movie had to have had a big, like Nightcrawler had to have had a bigger budget than Velvet Buzzsaw. But then I went back and the Velvet Buzzsaw budget was like $20 million. And Nightcrawler was only 8.5.
Oh, I guess. So I guess I believe I don't. I've never really been into or looking up it until, like, with the exception of isolated incidents. I'm never big into like budgets, but I believe the $8.5 million budget, but the $20 million budget for Velvet Buzzsaw. I mean, I guess there's some visual effects that had to go into play, and there are some actors that I'm sure had to be paid a certain amount, but not even. So I guess that does kind of surprise me. $20 million for a movie like for Velvet Buzzsaw. It almost seems like the budget should have been reversed.
Right. It felt to me like the Nightcrawler just looks so slick. It just does, looks great. And Velvet Buzzsaw doesn't. And so I've been going back and forth. I kind of think that that's on purpose for some reason, because it's clearly Dan Gilroy knows how to make a polished looking movie. Mm-hmm. And he just chose not to for this movie. I mean, this one scene when they go to the little party at the house on the water, there's a shot of the sky behind it that is like Tommy Wiseau-esque CGI. I mean, it is so bad.
I didn't even notice that.
Oh, it's so bad. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I'm like, what is going on in this movie? Where you see in Nightcrawler, it's like these beautiful vista shots of LA at night.
Why do you think it was on purpose?
So the only thing that I can come up with is that perhaps he wanted to make a schlocky film. Like he wanted to make a movie that like sort of looked and felt like a late 80s made for HBO film. Like he wanted to have that schlock cheap look to it. Because it's pretty clear that he could make the choice to have it look glossier and he chose not to. So my thinking he wants it to be more of that type of cheap horror film because that's what he wanted to make.
I would have never, that never even crossed my mind until you just said that. Honestly, I, cause this whole time, like I didn't not, obviously I've seen it. So I thought, you know, Velvet Buzzsaw had a slightly cheaper look, but I always just, and this is a whole separate conversation, I just always attribute that to Netflix.
Yes. I was thinking the same thing. Does Netflix do something with the way that they make their films look that it just always looks?
I think that they would have to. I think Roma is probably the only exception, and that's probably, I mean, that movie was like made and I think brought to Netflix after the fact. But at the same time, like an Academy Award winning director like Alejandro Iñárritu, he's going to be in control of stuff like that. He's not going to leave it into the hands of Netflix. But like a lot of Netflix movies look like the shows, you know?
Yeah.
It looks like looks like television.
No, that's exactly it. So I was I was wondering if that was it. Maybe I was giving Dan Gilroy like too much credit and assuming that he had full creative control. But yeah, no, I. But then there was a part of me that was like, oh, maybe this is just the Netflix way. Like, maybe this is just like, this is just what you have to do to get on Netflix. But I'll tell you, it did not prevent me from having nightmares, man. And I'm not saying that I'm not like Scott. Like, I'm not traumatized by horror films. I'm also,
right.
Like, also clearly Velvet Buzzsaw. Like, if you want to see a scary movie, either a scary movie that will gross you out or mess you up, or a movie that will make you, like, jump and scream, this is neither one of those movies.
Right.
However, something about Velvet Buzzsaw and something about, like, the existential dread that I sort of felt about these genuine people trying to be artists, and yet they're just making things worse, and then they all meet their demise, is, mm-hmm. like, it just, and that Hobo Man, and I know Hobo Man is supposed to be funny, but Hobo Man fucking freaks me out.
Well, that scene, exactly. Well, especially, you know, Gyllenhaal's demise, very much so. Well, again, it's funny. This is like the second time where it's like the way you feel about that is kind of how I felt about Nightcrawler. The whole final climax, like from the music to Riz Ahmed's death to like just the tension, the buildup of like, oh, something's about to go down in this fast food restaurant. Like, that made me feel uneasy.
Yeah.
And it's like a roller coaster of just like, oh, no, there's going to be a shootout. You know, oh, now he's, you know, Riz Ahmed's going to die. And now he doesn't care because he has to, Jake Gyllenhaal, or Lou rather, has to film this thing. And it's just like, it's all very, that is a little unsettling to me.
Did you do any Nightcrawler side-by-sides?
I did. I just can't, again, it's one of those things I can't remember of what. I feel like, I mean, it's pretty basic, but I feel like Drive would have been something. I definitely did Drive. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, now you got me going back. I'm not really trying to pat myself on the back, but I did a couple of interesting ones. Just like, so, there's that famous painting, I don't know how famous to people, but the artist, René Magritte, I guess most people know him, he's the artist who painted the bowler hat with the apple in front of the face. But he has this painting of, it's like a guy going out in the morning, and there's like a hat, but there's like, it's like a coat rack, but there's like different faces with facial expressions. And he's trying to pick, and the guy's picking what face he wants to use. And I compared that to, at the very beginning of Nightcrawler, before he gets into it with that security guard, you see he's trying out a couple of different faces before he's approached completely by this security guard. He, like, frowns, and then he tries a bunch of different smiles. So it's he's putting on a face, and then, I guess this makes sense. I compared it to Christine. The movie with Rebecca C. Hall about, I forgot her name, the Florida news woman who shot herself on air in the early 80s. Yeah. Lubitsch, Christine, fucking name's for the movie. Christine, yeah. But there's also, I'm going back now, but each movie, Rebecca Hall and Jake Gyllenhaal are doing this. There's this movement where they're like leaving their boss's office and they look back and point like, ha ha, you know, like that kind of phony, like wink and point, and that kind of, my aunt's calling me. Drive, obviously, like the way it's framed and set up, like where we first meet, Riz Ahmed's character, like the way they're sitting in the diner, it looks just like the diner scene in Drive. When he's talking to Carrie Mulligan, I guess I have done a couple. I forgot all about them because they're from like years ago. Yeah, wow, 2016, 2015. Oh yeah.
It definitely has a look and feel similar to that driving sequence. Like a lot of the movie has a similar look and feel to the opening driving sequence from Drive.
Yeah,
like it certainly has that nighttime sort of slick look because they're definitely driving around a lot in that Mustang towards the end of the movie.
Oh, definitely.
And then obviously, you know, Collateral, just the whole idea of like L.A. and the fact that Gyllenhaal said that he modeled himself after I, Coyote, where clearly like Tom Cruise in Collateral, he's doing the whole gray wolf thing.
Yeah, well, there's the scene where the wolf is crossing the street in Collateral. Yeah.
Yeah, not exactly subtle. Yeah, no, and then obviously I watched Medium Cool actually after I saw this movie.
Oh,
so
wow.
The whole idea of like going to a car accident and somebody being like alive and you're just like rolling tape instead of trying to help them, like Medium Cool just did that, was their opening scene.
Yeah, you know what? It's weird as you're talking. I realize I don't mean to sound pretentious or weird or whatever, but like Los Angeles is the one place. I don't like to sleep when I'm in Los Angeles. I like to stay up late and like hang out super, super, super late. I haven't been to LA in years, but anytime I go there, it's like, oh, I like to stay up late and be out till 2-3 in the morning. There's just something about the vibe there, the cool air. Everything. I just like to. LA is the kind of place I like to wander around. Like New York is, I don't know, New York is always crowded. People are always, and that's the other thing too. Like in Los Angeles, not everyone obviously, but like a good amount of people stay inside and go to sleep at a certain point. So it's like, and LA is obviously so spread out. So it's like you could just go on some random adventure and I like late night drives in Los Angeles. I very much so do.
See, I'm new to New York, so I like the late night of like being out and stuff. And I don't party. I don't, you know, I don't have any reason to be out late at night. But when I am, it's like there are just so many people in New York City, and it's just constantly. And plus, the other thing is that the food here is 24/7.
Oh, that's always a it's a big thing. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And so it's good food. That's fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. I definitely am really, really happy that you like made time to come on and chat. Is there anything else we wanted to talk about these movies that we didn't get a chance to discuss?
I'm trying to think. Not really. I think, actually I did. You know, it's funny. I wanted to make a point about how I feel about Los Angeles, what I just said. So I got to say that. So not really. I guess I'm big. I mean, even when you take out like, oh, I like to compare movies, you know, with each other. I'm big into like worlds that filmmakers create. You know what I'm saying? Like, and not just like some Tim Burton stuff. Like you can tell so and so. I like the subtle stuff where you can still look at something and tell like, oh, so and so directed this. So it's like, which is why going back to earlier, I'm so weirded out. And it's a movie I've seen. I didn't even pay attention to the fact that, you know, Dan Gilroy directed Roman J. Israel, because it's not. I mean, I guess if you give me a couple minutes to think about it, yeah, I can see some similarities with all of the films he's directed. But Nightcrawler and Drive kind of Nightcrawler and Velvet Buzzsaw, that was a slip there, are kind of like inhabit the same world, you know, and I'm big into that. Just like earlier, you know, like you said with Collateral, like I feel like all of Michael Mann's L.A. movies all take place like within the same world. Maybe not in the same time, but like. It's all the same universe, just spread over, you know, a couple of years. And I always appreciate when a city like Los Angeles, and Miami to some extent, Miami is like a light version of Los Angeles, but like when a director truly captures the vibe of what Los Angeles is, like I'm really into that. Even the fakeness, and it's like, I don't even mean this as an insult. I mean like, not just LA, but Southern California in general, a big part of that, it's all about Hollywood. Like, this is where the movies are made. Like, this is a generalization, obviously, but like, so many people have tried to act in LA. Like, everyone has a headshot. Everybody, there's something kind of like fake. And I don't mean that in a mean way, but it's like, everyone's trying to like, do something in the entertainment world. It can be very superficial, but there's also a dirty kind of seedier side to it. But it's still LA. It's still Southern California. So there's still like a beauty to it. There's still like the nice trees, the nice air, you know, like. And that's why I'm always fascinated with movies like Nightcrawler, or like I mistakenly said, like a movie like Drive. Drive looks beautiful, but that's a world I don't want to be in, because there's like this underbelly of like organized crime and like violence and people getting their heads shot off and whatnot. So I like that mix of like beauty and like brutal violence and whatnot. So
I recently started dating somebody, so I'm not using the apps anymore. But when I was on Bumble and I went out to LA, so I, at the time I was in Boston. So like you're in Boston and everything is like normal looking people, no plastic surgery. And everybody's talking about like the frickin' their masters that they got at MIT or whatever. Like they're all like intellectuals and all this other stuff. Then you go to LA and no, it's just people with headshots.
It's true.
It's just headshot after headshot, and it's just totally different. It's just totally different value system.
That's funny. We didn't even mention the fact this is that we're both from Massachusetts. Parts.
I was gonna mention it because when you were saying you were at college, I was at UMass Amherst, living in Southwest.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow. Oh wait. Oh, did you tell me you were in Southwest? That's where the cool. I don't know about like. Well, no, we're the same age. So like Southwest was like the cool dorm.
Yeah, no, Southwest had, I lived in the towers 4 straight years. I never moved off campus because I just liked living in the dorm so much. I mean, to be fair, I don't understand why you would move away. Like, I was just partying and hanging out with girls, and it was like you were in the dorms. If a girl wanted to come over, she just had to, like, walk to the next building. So, like, why people left, I was like, yeah, but then you have to drive, and, you like, nobody's around. It's like, no, man, I want to be in the dorms. With the parties
funny,
man.
I it's so funny. So growing up in Amherst, Massachusetts, I lived 1 street over from Fraternity Row.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I lived on Amity Street, down the street from the Jones Library, right by the center of town. So it's like since I was a kid, so since the age of 7 up until, you know, I thought college was like, I'd been surrounded by, you know, it's like Amherst College, UMass, Smith, Mount Holyoke, Hampshire College. So I thought all colleges were like this. So when I went to a private college where there were like non-co-ed nothing. There was like the men's dorms, which were across campus, and the women's dorms, which I like growing up where I did. I thought I was going to be prepared for college because it's like, oh, it's party 24/7, you know, but then it definitely wasn't.
Yeah, because Amherst is really the same way. All my friends that went to Amherst College, they partied like crazy, and don't even get me started on Smith. That place is, wow. There's nothing, like, guys in frat houses, I always thought, like, okay, so, like, that's the craziest that people can get. No, man, you get just women living together.
Oh, the ladies?
And it's,
okay.
Oh, yeah, they get. I went to some, I heard these rumors of, what were they called? They were called immorality parties. And I was like, that sounds crazy. So I never went to
more.
One. So I never went to one when I was in college. But then I graduated, and one of my friends, Katie, she was still going to Smith. I knew her, like, she lived in Boston over the summer. So she invited me to go to Smith to an immorality party. And I'm telling you, it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen.
Whoa.
And and then the next morning you wake up, and these, you know, these women that all live in the dorm together, they're all giving each other nasty looks. And then I'd be like, why are you giving her a nasty look? She's like, oh, we used to date and now we hate each other. And I'm like, what is going, like, what? Everybody is,
wow.
It was insane. It was just, it was a total madhouse. I don't know. I mean, obviously many of my, I don't want to sound like a misogynist. A lot of my friends got like really great education at Smith. However, my one party there was the craziest party I'd ever been to.
You know, it's funny, going back to what you were saying, too, about, like, the difference between being in Boston and L.A., I thought you were immediately going to just talk about sports. Like, I spent a lot of time in Boston, and it's always – immediately, it just goes right to sports. And it's all, and I'm not really a big sports guy. I mean, I used to watch basketball. I can't wait till next season because now that things have been shaken up and, you know, talent has been dispersed throughout the league, I'll probably be watching basketball more. But, like – I don't watch football, let alone play. I hated when I played football. I don't watch baseball. So it's like whenever I'm in Boston, right away, someone's like, so who do you got in the so-and-so playoffs? I'm like, I have no idea what you're like. I'm like Roger Clemens and Mo Vaughn. Those are like the last two. That's all I remember. And they're so like, I mean, I guess I'm like a big, tall guy. So, you must have done sport. And I did. I mean, I played sports in high school, but it's like that's the first thing they go to. Like my old job. I lived in Boston for 3 months a few years ago. And when I went to the Boston office, it's just like, "Hi, I'm Marcus." And it's like, "Oh, you're from the New York office. Oh, you're a Yankees fan." It's like, "No, I'm not. I don't even watch baseball. Like, no. Like, there's other stuff about me. It's not just about sports." So, but anyway.
No, yeah. That's funny. That's funny. No, I once I stopped playing. No, I mean, actually, I was into it when I was first in Boston, but then it was also like we won everything really kind of quickly. And at a certain point, it's like, I get it. You know, there's nowhere to go from there. It's like, all right, fine. We won everything. I went to all the parades. Now, all right, fine. I need to find a new hobby, dude.
Sure. And like, you know, it's funny you say that. Cause even though I grew up in Massachusetts, my roots are in New York City. So my dad, vastly different. He was, he did love the Yankees and, you know, for the most part, the Yankees are always great. But then at the same time, he's also a Knicks fan. So it's like, growing up, you know, like in a Knicks household, you know, it's a little rough. But as far as baseball goes, well, shit, even football. The Giants won quite a few Super Bowls in my lifetime thus far. So I kind of know what I know what you mean. Basketball, they just can't seem to get it together.
It's, you know, I honestly have no, I have no idea what to say about sports recently. I just found out that the Raptors won the championship. So I'm,
did you really? Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, I guess I did know that because Drake had to choose which team he was going to support. Cause he had like Golden State Warrior tattoos, but yeah, he's from Canada.
Yep.
So
yeah, it's funny. I mean, if anybody ever wants to talk pro wrestling, I'm definitely, I'll talk that, but a lot of people don't even consider that a sport. So, you know,
my brother, I was the best man at my brother's wedding and I gave a speech and it was about, Hulk Hogan versus the Ultimate Warrior.
Oh yeah. WrestleMania 7.
Yeah. That was he and I were like 6 and 7 years old and really into wrestling. And,
that makes sense. Yeah.
I gave a long speech about he was a Ultimate Warrior supporter and I was a Hulk Hogan.
Wow.
I was a little Hulkamaniac. And so, anyways. So I haven't watched wrestling recently, but, basically you just turn on a movie. It feels like all the WWE guys are now going and becoming superstars. So
they are. But what's great is though, and it's going to be on TNT, there's a new wrestling promotion that's starting. Well, it already has started, but it's going to be on Wednesday, starting the first week in October. Cody Rhodes, Dusty Rhodes' son, started a new wrestling promotion.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I'm not going to say competent. I don't think anyone can compete with WWE, but it's nice to know that there's like an alternative because WWE kind of sewed everything up, and then they watered down there, which is kind of shitty because it's like they're the only – They're the biggest dance in town, and it's not even like a fun dance. And now there's going to be an alternative come this fall, so I'm excited about that.
So
and Chris, they got Chris Jericho. Yeah, no, they have some big names. Yeah. Chris Jericho can still go. He's in his mid late 40s, and he's still killing it.
Marcus, I'm glad you suggested talking about this. I really just wanted to. This is like I had James Hancock on, and that was like that was a big thing for me because his podcast was one of the first ones I was listening to. You know, outside of like the professional stuff, like his was one of the first ones where I was like, "Oh man, that's amazing! I want to
do
that."
Sure, James is a great guy. It's funny because years ago, at this 2015 at this point, Martin Kessler was on Wrong Reel. It was the Amadeus episode, and they went off into a tangent about movie comparisons, and then Martin, who I actually had met at that point, like mentioned me, and then our friend Aaron West, who runs the Criterion podcast, he happened to just like DM me. He's like, "Hey, just so you know, Martin Kessler shouted you out on Wrong Reel." And I was like, "Oh, cool." And then like a couple of days later, James was just like, "Hey, do you want to do the show?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, definitely." And then it's just been, you know, that's kind of been my – I like to say, I mean, Pink Smoke is my second home, but Wrong Reel became like my third home, you know.
Yeah, no, Martin was the first person to ask me on a podcast, and Aaron was the first person to have me on a podcast.
Awesome.
Because Martin's schedule is a little bit lagged. But, yeah, no, when I had James on to discuss a book that we had both read a few episodes back, that was like a dream come true. That was like the circle was being closed, you know.
Yeah, man.
And then I listened, like I said, I listened to Zebras in America fairly religiously, so obviously me and my friends are excited for whenever episode 99 comes out.
Yeah,
because then
yeah,
it means
we're gonna
just
be,
one Yeah, one more episode to 100.
Yeah, we have a little a special thing we're doing for episode 100. But this weekend we're gonna get together. We're gonna record a couple. Well, I mean, we always pre-record like 2 to 3 episodes in one sitting, just so that you know we don't fall behind. But this little hiatus we've been taking was definitely intentional. We just wanted a little break and you know all that.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely want to have you back on, and I definitely want to chat with Scott sometime soon. I've met you a couple of times in person, and I still haven't gotten to see Scott face to face, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah,
no,
he didn't even come to my housewarming party. No, I'm kidding. He's going to hear this and be mad. I'm joking, Scott. I'm joking.
I figured he just showed up after I left, cuz I left kind of early to come back to do a thing, but
He was out of town that weekend. People showed. My uncle and my cousin came like hours later. It kind of went on for a little while.
That's awesome. Yeah, like yeah. I said this on my last episode that I released, that I think your building is the nicest building I've ever been in. Like, not just hung out in, it's like the nicest one I've ever stepped foot in.
This of any apartment I've lived in three different boroughs, various neighborhoods in the, you know, 14 years that I've lived in New York City. But you know, all the amenities are open now. Yeah, man, you gotta come, you know, come by sometime again. Like, we're gonna be grilling a lot all summer. We're kind of we're doing a kind of a follow-up get-together, because there were like a couple of folks, my good friend Rob Cotto and my friend John Cross at the After Movie Diner, and a few other folks who couldn't make it. So we wanted to have some more people over for another cookout. So, I mean, yeah, you know, you're always welcome.
I would love to meet Bradley Cornish at some time. So I've been on his show a couple of times, but it's like I have to be careful, because his sort of like manic, random sense of humor brings out that in me to an extent where it's like I have to like rein myself back in, because like I'm a working professional. I need to not get in trouble. The only time I've asked somebody to edit something I said, because I felt like it was slightly too offensive, was right. I made a joke about Miss 45 after you guys were on. And if you remember, it was like during that episode came out around the time that the Brett Kavanaugh stuff was going on. Made a joke about Miss 45 in the Supreme Court. And afterwards, I was like, dude, you have to take that. I sound like a dick. You have to erase that. But Bradley, when I talk to him, man, it's so much fun. It's like one of those hilarious like conversations I had when I was, I don't know, like when I was like 15 years old, where you just laugh the whole time. The dude is awesome.
And he's just a super nice guy. He's like real supportive. He's like always like, I'll just go to sleep one night and then I'll wake up in the morning and he dug up something I wrote from like 2012 and like he shared it. I'm like, oh man, you actually had to go look for that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. He is. And then there's been times where like, whether it was summer hours at my old job or just like I got home earlier than expected, I'll just text him. I'm just like, hey, I'm home. My lady's not going to be home for a while. Do you want to just like record something on the, like we've done a few, like we recently, about last month, we did a random episode about Dreyer's Vampyr. The episode we did, I think it was either late last year or beginning of this year, me, him, and Martin Kessler did an episode on Twin Peaks, the Return. Yeah. And that was like totally, we were DMing, and then we were just like, do you want to just start recording what we're saying? Like, so there's been a couple of times just on the fly, we're just like, all right, you guys all want to get on Skype? And yeah.
Dude, I gotta do that. I also have to reach out to Bradley. I haven't been on his podcast in a while, and
he's taking a little hiatus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he hasn't been recording for a while because my lady, who she works for, she works in the movie and TV industry. She's out at Comic-Con, and then she's in LA. So I was texting Bradley. I was like, hey, for like a good 12 days solid, I'm going to have more free time on my hands if you want to record. And he's like, no, I told my wife I would like, you know, take a month off or so for recording. I was like, oh, all right.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Bradley, we're thinking about you if you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah, man.
Marcus.
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome. Just, yeah. You know, like I said, totally grateful. This is like, I've been listening to Zebras in America for a while, following your side by sides on Twitter, and just
nice,
yeah,
I appreciate that, man.
It's awesome. And on top of that, like most importantly, you totally were the first one of the first people to reach out when I came to New York City and like invite me to a movie and stuff. So you know, absolutely. It's a big move for me. So it meant a lot that, you know, that you did that, invited me to the housewarming and everything. So awesome to have you on the podcast.
Yeah.
Let people know again, in case they miss it, I'm going to put it in the notes. I'm definitely going to put it in the link to the essay, but remind them where they'd, you know, about Pinland Empire and the podcast and everything.
Yeah, go to PinlandEmpire.com. I'm on Twitter, at @Pinland_Empire. And the other account that both Scott and I run, the Zebras Twitter, it's at Zebras Pod. And just if you just Google Zebras in America, we're on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, all the, you know, places where, you know, podcasts are. So, yeah, just Pinland Empire. Just Google that and you'll come up with everything that I do online.
Awesome. And if you guys ever need a third mic for Zebras, definitely.
Oh, of course. I mean, you're in the city. Yeah, we'll have to figure it out.
I'm down to podcast anytime if it means getting on to, you know.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out because it's like you're in Manhattan, Scott's in Brooklyn, I'm in Queens, but we'll make it work.
So if anybody wants to listen to more of this podcast, Film Baby Film, you can find us on Twitter at Film Baby Film, and there's a filmbabyfilm.com, although I'm not really using that anymore. I'm really now switched on to the 25th Frame Media, which Aaron West is the network that Aaron West started, Aaron and Cole Roulain from The Magic Lantern. A lot of great podcasts on that, you know, and friends of ours, Dave Eves, does a lot of episodes, and, you know, a lot of people that I like. And so, yeah, so subscribe to this podcast, Film Baby Film. Or even better, get the 25th Frame Media, get the master feed so you can listen to this show and all of the other cool shows that we have. So, and yeah, definitely follow Pinland Empire on Twitter. It's probably like one of the five movie Twitter follows that's worth anything. So,
thank you, man. I really appreciate that.
Marcus, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your time, man. This has been great.
My pleasure.
25thframemedia.com. A listener-supported network celebrating film and culture worldwide.